Hi, I'm Jen Drummond. Welcome to Seek Your Summit. As a mom, a business owner, and the first female to climb the 7-second summits, I realize that the mountains we climb are a part of our success. And it is up to us to go beyond that success into a life of significance. Listen in as I share personal stories and interview others who have led a life of both success and significance, and now they are paying it forward. Friends, on the podcast today, I am so excited that we have Scott Fedor. Okay, I read his book. His memoir is jaw-dropping. Set aside the day because you won't want to put it down. And his story is resilience at the nth degree. Like, he makes me look like a wimp in the field of resilience. And you all know my story. So, Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you. And I don't know about the wimp part, but I appreciate the comments. So thank you.
Yes.
Great to be here.
Yes. Okay. So, I mean, this whole story is just so much to unpack, and it's crazy because I grew up in Michigan. Okay. And so your accident happened in Michigan in a lake not too far from me. I grew up in Holland, Michigan. Okay. You were in Kalamazoo, yep. Michigan. And growing up, it is like the fear of God is put into you on do not dive in shallow water. Do not. If you can't see the bottom, even if you can see the bottom, you need to be safe. And like, I have nightmares about it. And then I've read your book and I'm like, oh, yep. This is insanity, especially because you dove off the dock the day before.
Yes. It was in Coldwater Lake. So we were about an hour or so from Kalamazoo. Kalamazoo was where I ended up going to the hospital. But let me just back up and say that I was a trained lifeguard and swim instructor. And I used to teach young children the proper techniques to do a swimmer's dive. And I knew, I knew how to dive. And the cottage that I was at, very familiar with. And I had actually been up there a couple of weeks earlier, diving in that same spot. And it was just one of those freak perfect storms where the weather was just extremely hot and dry that summer. So the water was constantly, the levels were receding. And for whatever reason, at that moment in time, when I took that dive off that dock, I still to this day, I've retraced it 1,000 times in my head. I don't know if I would have done anything differently, except obviously going feet first. But it was just one of those things. And when I hit the water, I knew right away what had happened. I didn't black out. I hit with such force that, that it smashed my neck, obliterated my neck. But I never lost consciousness. So unfortunately, I sat there floating in what ended up being about 33 inches of water and knew that this was it. This was the end, and all those thoughts that you can only imagine go through your mind that you don't imagine ever having to deal with started going through my mind. Incredible sense of guilt was the first thing I thought. I was married at the time, and I thought, Jesus, Scott, you just destroyed not only your life, but your wife's life, your family's life, any family you hope to have. And then that guilt kind of quickly started being replaced by fear once I realized, okay, I just dove off a dock on a beautiful day and everything going for me, and I just broke my neck. And, I knew right away what had happened. I had played football as an athlete, baseball. I had had a lot of injuries in the past, but, I knew at that moment in time this was something that I'm not coming back from. And I sat there just flooded with emotion, a lot of fear, a lot of guilt, a lot of sadness. My heart was beating so loud, so fast, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And you just start quickly taking stock of what time you have left. And, there's an overwhelming sense of sadness. I thought I was going to die alone. All those that I loved and that were near and dear to me weren't there. And not only were they not there, they were also proximity wise up in the house, which was a good 50 yards away, kind of up the side of an embankment. So I had gone down there by myself, and I was completely alone when I dove in. There was no one there. And, you know, said my prayers, kind of thought long and hard about what, you know, what was next, and ultimately decided to swallow water to drown myself because I knew that no one was coming for me. I was by myself. I couldn't push off. I could see this just muddy bottom of a lake, and I just could not reach it. There was not, I couldn't move anything. And this was it. I was ready to die alone. Not ready, but I knew I was going to die alone, cold, wet, scared. And that was it. So I swallowed water, and I ended up drowning myself. And what I didn't know is that, as luck would have it, talk about man's best friend, Eddie, one of the dogs that was at the cottage with us, had followed me down the stairs, down out onto the pier. And when I dove in, Eddie was at the end, bottom of the pier, or at, you know, just on the pier there, and was barking at me, realizing that, you know, hey, Scott's not coming back up. He's kind of just floating on the water there. And it was that bark that alerted those up in the cottage to kind of look out and realize, hey, wait a minute, you know, something's not right. And then that's when they kind of came down. They got me. No one had known what had happened. No one had seen me dive in. They had, you know, some people had said they had heard it, but, you know, they didn't know my neck was broken. So they jumped in and they're jostling me around and pulling me out of the lake, pulling me up onto the pier. And then what, you know, you thought, okay, we got this guy out of the water now. Well, obviously, you know, my heart had stopped. I had stopped breathing. Fortunately, one of the individuals was an ICU nurse, and she was able to perform mouth-to-mouth CPR, kind of get somewhat of a pulse. But they called the ambulance, and as luck or misluck would have it, the ambulance took 45 minutes to get to where I was, just because the routing of the, you know, we were in a very rural area, and where the all those little, you know, as you know, all those little roads back winding around the lake, they just weren't marked properly. So it took 45 minutes. So fortunately for me, I had the right people there at that time who just kind of kept me hanging on until the ambulance got there, realized what had happened. And then at that point, as you mentioned earlier, you know, I was life flight up to Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Yeah. It's like, I can, when you talk about that moment of guilt, right? When you first jump in, and I just remember when I watched the car hit the semi truck that I was in, and that moment of guilt is so real, right? You're sitting there thinking, wait a minute, I shouldn't have been like, I should have been focusing on the, like all the should haves, right? I should have been focusing on the road more. Why did I pay so much attention to the reservoir? Why was I driving so fast? Why was the car going so slow?
But in actuality though, you, and the funny thing you got to deal with too is, you know, you asked those questions, but you still weren't doing anything wrong, you know, and that's what kind of, I think
crazy.
That's right. Why the guilt just, you can't wish it away, because even though you weren't doing anything wrong, that guilt is just still there. And I think that's just like, as you know, when you're at that moment, when you're facing your mortality and you realize that this is it, and at that point in time, you think there is no coming back from this. Yeah. That guilt is overwhelming.
And I just remember it goes so fast, yet time dilates to this so slow motion. And I just remember thinking, I was like, did I say I love you to everybody this morning? Did I, was I nice to everybody that I interacted with before I got into this car accident? Well, people, you know, like it was just, I remember taking an inventory of everybody that was important to me and being like, when was the last time I called my mom? When was the last time I did these things? And it was just, it was crazy because it happens this fast, yet you have days worth of thoughts when you spread them out and say them.
No, it really does slow down. And I went through that same litany of questions, just thinking, and it wasn't so much thinking when was the last time I did this as much as I was on the other end of realizing I'm never going to do this again. You know, I'm never going to be able to hug my mom again. I'm never going to be able to tell anyone I love them again. I'm not going to be able to, you know, dance or play in a living room with children, you know, that I'll have, or or just to get to see my niece and nephew grow up. So everyone always talks about your life flashing before your eyes. For me, it was more of the life I hadn't lived that started flashing before my eyes. And, you know, that sadness, that guilt, that fear, you know, there wasn't. And I don't know if it's due to my circumstance of how traumatic, and in your situation, you know, I'm not sure what you felt, but of just how traumatic of an injury it was, but there was no sense of calmness with knowing that death was approaching. For me, I was scared out of my mind. I couldn't breathe, obviously, so I had all the physiological stuff going on that, you know, that would heighten that fear. But yeah, for me, it was a moment of sheer terror and sadness and fright. And that's why I ultimately figured the best thing to do at that point was just swallow water, as opposed to just waiting there for the inevitable to happen anyway. And, you know, that's why I ended up choosing to do what I did. Thankfully, yeah, you know, the story does have a happy ending, but, yeah, that real sense of dread, is unlike anything that I hope to ever have to experience again.
No, I mean, come on. Yeah, and I think like the big difference between your and my experience for sure is that you were in an environment that you couldn't breathe, right? So yeah, I was in an environment where like the minute the accident happened, I just let go. I just surrendered. I just was like, I cannot beat this car. It is going to go so fast. Things are going to go way out of it. Like the only thing I can do is try to roll with it as much as possible. So I just need to let go and not resist, because if I resist, I'm going to get injured. And yep. So I had that clarity, but I could breathe, right? And it's fascinating how breath dictates thoughts, right? Why is meditation so strong?
Yep,
why
absolutely. You're right.
Yep. All that stuff. So I think for you, when you can't breathe, that brings in a whole different experience than when me, I could.
I think you nailed it. The idea of when you're in a traumatic situation, a lot of people will tell you, okay, focus on your breath, because you use that breath as kind of a crutch to either calm down or to just kind of help buy yourself some time to figure out what's going on. You know, I didn't have that option. And it was the other side. You know, rather than calm down, it just kept, the anxiety kept ratcheting up because you can't breathe. Right. And, you know, you're trying to take stock of everything going on. But like you said, just being in an environment without having the ability to breathe, that really did a number on me. And the other thing about that, too, is, you know, as you could probably relate to with your high altitude experience, you know, that feeling of hypoxia was there. And, you know, I don't know how long I was in the water for. They estimate that maybe it was 4, 5, 6 minutes, but no one really knows. But I started thinking that those that I loved were sitting right there on the dock. And I was hoping that they realized something was wrong and they could dive in and get me, but there was no one there, but clear as day, except for the dog, but clear as day, I was thinking, you know, you guys are watching me, hurry up, kind of dive in. And for all I know, that could have been hypoxia that was, you know, mm-hmm. starting to set in. And what seemed like, you know, you talk about things going so quick yet lasting so long. You know, those 4 minutes felt like 30 seconds, but it also felt like an eternity because I was processing all these thoughts, you know, rifling through a, you know, it's just a, you know, a Rolodex of emotions.
You know, I've been lucky at altitude. I do quite well with it. I haven't had the hallucinations, but I've seen it, right? So I had a friend who got caught up high. And so he had to have his hand amputated because he had frostbite and all this kind of stuff. And like, there was people there trying to help him and he thought they were trying to hurt him. And so he was kicking at them with crampons on and like all this stuff. And so from the outside, you're looking at it like, buddy, like these are the people that are trying to save you. You could kill them now. Like, come on. But when you're in that hypoxic place, like nightmares happen or right? Like you're watching your family just sit there wondering like, why are they not saving me? And here he has this scenario where people are saving him and he's trying to kill them. And you're just, it's a fascinating, complex situation.
It is. And it's just, it can happen without warning to the, you know, just so quickly that once it comes on, if you're not able to reverse it quickly, you know, your mind's just going to let go. And, you know, it's tough to come back from that and control it. So, you know, because I had drowned and my lungs were so compromised and obviously the severity of the injury and the trauma, they had put me on some serious medication. And, you know, this wasn't hypoxia, but I started having some serious hallucinations from some of the drugs that they had me on. And what was even more scary now was I was laying in a hospital bed, kind of aware that something bad had happened, but I couldn't control my thoughts. And my mind started playing tricks on me where, you know, I'd be awake talking to people I found out, but then I would just suddenly hallucinate, see their faces morph into something horrible or hideous, or just get these paranoid feelings that everyone was out to get me. And because I had been paralyzed and, you know, I had lost the ability to talk, I couldn't really, you know, I had no muscles to project any kind of voice. I was on breathing machine, a ventilator breathing for me. All I could do was really blink my eyes or try to whisper. I had no way of communicating to people that, hey, something's not right. I'm seeing weird things here. Kind of don't know where I am. I'm not recognizing stuff. And so on top of that, I'm laying there with a broken neck, unable to move, trying to process all this. And now I felt like I was actually in hell, like a living hell, because I was convinced that everyone around me was there trying to hurt me and I could get better if they would just let me go. But yeah, the drugs and the sedatives and all the medication that they had me on, it took a little while for them to realize that, okay, you know, something's not right with Scott. He's just not reacting the way we want. So it was like, you know, it's another double whammy on top of what had just happened.
I can't even imagine not being able to advocate for yourself, right? Like to have people doing what they're trying to do to best help you, but you have no way of letting anybody know, like, abort, abort, like this is not working.
Wow. It was the worst, you know, it was the worst possible nightmare I could conceive or would ever want to find myself in, because, you know, you realize how powerful the mind is. And when you have a clear mind and you're lucid and you can think straight, you know, I'd like to think of myself and do to this day as a problem solver. And okay, you know, all right, Scott, you're in this situation, you know, look at the tools around you, figure out how do you use what you have to kind of, you know, get yourself out of this into a better situation. And my best tool, my mind, was kind of at that point in time completely compromised and taken away from me. So not only could I not physically move, mentally and just cognitively, I felt just as paralyzed with what was going on with the drugs. So it was, I tell people to this day, it's as if in the immediate aftermath of my injury for those probably first 2 weeks or so, it's as if all of my thoughts were just, and everything that happened, all the events were all just randomly thrown into a pillowcase, shaken about, and then just picked out one at a time, placed in some random order, linearly, I can't piece together what happened first, what happened second. I remember events happening, but really have no recollection of the order that they happened in, because it was just a jumbled mess at that point in time.
I can't even imagine. And the fracture you had was one of those like full neck fractures. Like it was one of the most extreme fractures you can possibly have. It closed neck.
It was an internal decapitation. And C1 through C6 had all broken at the C3 level. The C3 vertebrae and C4 completely dislocated. And it was an interior decapitation. So at that point in time, right after the injury, it was just muscle and tendons and skin that were kind of keeping my neck in place. It was pretty bad. Why I'm alive, I really don't know to this day, Jen. I tell you, I am not just the drowning. I mean, the drowning in and of itself was pretty remarkable, but just the severity and the fact that I never even lost consciousness, how my body has survived, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I can honestly say with some scientific fact, I was decapitated, and fortunately was able to survive that. And the surgeon, it was a 12-hour surgery. He ended up telling my family that it was one of the worst injuries he had ever seen in his life. And, you know, he did his part. The rest would be, up to God and how my body chose to respond and chose to recover. So it was pretty much had everything working against me.
I know.
And it's still remarkable when I tell it to this day, 14 and a half years later.
Well, even still, because when I listened, when I read the story, it's not like you were near death once. I mean, you dipped into that danger zone a few different times with things that were going on with having to aspirate your lungs and having this, that, and the other thing. I'm like, give this guy a break. Someone stop. Where's this voodoo doll? And let's freaking find it.
That's exactly what I felt like with someone's voodoo doll. You know, just couldn't find out who was controlling it, because, there were a few full codes there. And I even had a full code at one point about, maybe 3 months post-injury, when I had been moved back to a hospital in Cleveland for rehab, and had even coded again on some aspirating on some some stuff in my lungs. Yeah, I really felt like that I had really upset the wrong person, because I could not get a break. And that was a challenge, because there was a point in time where doctor came to my bedside and, had told me, okay, Scott, this is what happened. You broke your neck. You're never going to move again. You're never going to breathe on your own again. You're not going to be able to eat or swallow, and probably won't be able to get out of bed again. The rest of your life is just going to be about trying to be as comfortable as you can. And at that point in time in my life, I was 33, and I was a vice president working for a Fortune 100 company, was married, was living the dream life that I had always aspired to. And just like that, it was all gone. And now I have this so-called expert telling me even worse what I have to look forward to. And what I didn't realize was, in Michigan, there's the right to life law, where if you are of sound mind but are on artificially controlled means to keep you alive, you're allowed to be given that choice at that moment of, at that first moment of impact, or those first couple of days when something happened, whether or not you want to continue to live. And I was given that choice. He came in, told me all this stuff, and then asked me, okay, do you want to live? And up until that point, while I was in the hospital, again, I don't know if it was 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, whatever it was, all I kept praying to God was to die, because I was having these horrible hallucinations. I realized, what I had done to my neck, my body, to my wife, to myself, to my potential future. And here I was, in a way, this angel of death, if you want to call it, in the form of a doctor, now saying, okay, do you want to live?
Yeah.
Yep.
And for some reason, you wanted to live.
Yep. And I, whether it was the Holy Spirit, whether it was, my inner spirit, whatever it was, it came right out. And with the loudest whisper I could muster, I was like, yes, I want to live. And that was completely contrary to everything I had been thinking or would have been going on. So I chalked that up to God saying, hey, I'm not done with you yet. I got some plans for you, Scott. You may not know it, but this is probably the worst thing that's going to happen to you, but things are going to get better from here. Don't worry. But at that point in time, I, consciously, I did not want to live, but subconsciously there was something that won out, that won that battle at the moment. And, looking back, obviously, thank God I said yes, but I still don't know how or why I said yes to this day.
I'll tell you, when I was reading that section of the book, I remember pausing and thinking, like, when you said, like, I wish I died, I wanted to die, I wanted to die. I'm like, yeah, I totally get it. I would be there too. And then when the doctor asked and you're like, I want to live, I'm like, man, I don't know if I would have made that choice. And I have 7 kids.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and I don't know if I would have made the choice. Yes, I'm grateful to never have to have that experience. So universe, I'm not calling it in. But I just remember reading it. I'm like, wow, that is one brave, courageous human.
There was a gentleman down the hall who had been given that choice before they came into my room. So to set the scene, my family's outside in the hallway and they realized, you know, the doctor had told them, hey, we got to, you know, Scott has the right to be able to answer this question. So we're going to go talk to him in a few minutes. And they saw the doctor go into this other room to ask a father whose children were there, and he chose to not want to live. And, you know, they saw everyone come out of that room crying and later saw his body being moved out of that room. So my parents are thinking, oh my gosh, you know, now they're going to go ask Scott. And I could have had anyone in the room. I said, I just wanted my wife in the room. So they came in and they had now had to watch the doctor kind of go from this situation right into my room to go give me that same exact choice. And knowing what I had been feeling and what I had been seeing, the pain that I had, that they had seen me in for those days, I don't think they were expecting me to say yes either. And to your point, I don't think anyone would have faulted me had I said no. Because I only knew what I knew at that point in time. My body's completely destroyed. My mind is not in the right place. But yet somehow, you know, there was something inside
there's
of me
divine
that
divine intervention.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's just not words for it, right? There's these moments that I've had 3 near-death experiences. And every one of them, there's been this moment where it's like something intercepted. I don't have a word for it, but it was like, there's like, I'm dead. Like, you have that. You're like, I'm dead. And then all of a sudden you're not. And you're sitting there thinking, okay, I have angels because they just intercepted again.
Yep.
And for some reason I'm still here. So let's go.
I think you do have a word for it. Like, you know, divine intervention. I think that's really the only way to explain situations like that you've been through and, you know, that I've dealt with and others who have been, well, that statistically you shouldn't come out of the situation.
Right.
Yet somehow, all the odds against you, you do survive. And, you know, for me, it's okay to say, okay, that is divine intervention because I can't think of anything else to explain it. So, you know, until you can prove to me otherwise, I'm like, all right, you know, someone was there looking out for me. That's for sure.
Definitely. Definitely. How do you stay in a mode of gratitude? Like, how do you approach each day grateful? Because it's like your days are a lot harder than mine.
Well, first of all, to that point, I will say it's all relative. You know, a lot of people tell me that, oh, you know, Scott, I've been through something tough, but nothing that you've been through. And I understand the meaning or what they're trying to convey, but I always tell people it is all relative because every single person has a different arsenal of tools at their disposal, a different village, if you will, of, you know, of people behind them or resources or the way you've been raised, the way your brain's matured and what you've been taught to believe in tools you've acquired to kind of deal with negativity or positivity. Everyone is in a different situation. So while you might compare, okay, a car accident versus a broken neck versus, you know, a medical diagnosis or cancer, it is all, I do think it is all relative. So it's tough to say one's worse than another, if that makes sense. But to your point, in the, you know, the spirit of what you're asking, we all have to find that right attitude to deal with the situation we've been given. And for me, it wasn't easy, you know, to get to that point of gratitude. I talk about my book. I wasn't this Pollyanna that was like, okay, all right, God's given me some adversity. Let's go. Let's roll up the sleeves and go attack it. I mean, I was pissed off. I was mad. I was upset. I was struggling to accept the fact that the life I had was going to change. I didn't want to think about a future that I couldn't control, or feel that I could control. So for the longest time, when I woke up in the mornings, first thought in my head was, shit, I'm still paralyzed. And then the second thought, or that thought kind of leads to a little bit of animosity, a little bit of just kind of, gruffness. You just, all right, great. Now I got to go through my day and put on this great attitude and try to, deal with the fact that I can't move. Here's another day where nothing's come back. So that process of getting out of that and getting to the point where I felt grateful each day, it took a while. It didn't happen overnight. But what led me to get there was I started to kind of force myself to, okay, Scott, go through the motions, so to speak. Just get up, go do the therapy, go try not to think too far ahead about tomorrow or the next day or after that. Just one foot, kind of like climbing that mountain. When you have zero strength, all you're thinking about is just that next foot. Just place that one foot down, and then I'll worry about how to, so to speak, how to drag my next foot forward to take that next step. So for me, it was those metaphorical steps. Just get up, do the therapy. Okay. Come back, do what's next, do that, do just focusing on those immediate little steps in front of me. And that kind of became a habit. And next thing you know, I call it the inches, the inch by inch, it's a cinch. Next thing you know, it's just those little inches are adding up to steps, those steps to yards, those yards to miles. And you start to look up and you realize, okay, a week has passed, a month has passed, 2 months have passed, and I'm slowly getting stronger. There's still setbacks, but I'm starting to string together, a series of good days. Might then have a bad day, but then I'm able to bounce back and get those good days again. So it just became a habit of just forcing myself to just deal with all the bullshit and just take one step at a time. And ultimately, you start hitting milestones along the way. For me, I was able to get off the ventilator to breathe again. I could eat on my own again. I was able to start spending time in a wheelchair, being out of bed, going to see a movie, going to a restaurant, going out and spending a day outside with the sun on my face. So all these little things that I was told I was never going to have again, I started being able to experience. And there's the appreciation that comes with that. And also the realization that, okay, people don't know. The doctors can tell me what's going on at that moment in time, but they can't account for my will or for my fight, or for, what my body's gonna, how hard I'm gonna choose to continue to pursue my life. So that ultimately you start seeing yourself accomplish those things. And then that's where the gratitude started to set in for me. It's like, okay, I'm gonna wake up, because now the first thought in my head is like, okay, wow, I got a lot of stuff I wanna do today. Let's go get it done. As opposed to, damn, I can't move. I'm just going to sit here and, lament on that. So my gratitude has developed as a result of being able to reflect on the fact that I'm doing things I was told I wouldn't be able to do. And in a weird way, when I'm having a bad day, I may look back and remember what it was like in that hospital bed. That was a bad day. So it kind of puts things in perspective. Sure, I still can't move. I might not be able to, to go run a marathon, to go climb a mountain, to go mow my lawn. But there's a lot of things I can do. I'm just doing them from the chair for the time being. So it helps put things in perspective. And I really do try to focus on those inches, in every little victory, because you know those little victories are still victories. So you just celebrate, even if it's a little victory, and next thing you know, it adds up into a you know, the culmination of all those little battles. You know, they end up becoming much, much bigger victories. So it didn't happen overnight, but it does happen. And that's the important thing to remember, is that I think we can all find something in our lives to be grateful for, no matter how awful the situation is, whether by our own choosing or just, you know, by an act of God, whatever unfortunate adversity we find ourselves dealing with, you know, there's a time to face that and deal with it, but there is a time to be grateful and to seek out the gratitude that, you know, that is there. And a lot of times you don't have to look too far for it. You know, it is right there. You just have to be open to, you know, to receiving it and realizing and in a way letting go and accepting, you know, things are going to be different.
Yeah.
And that was another valuable lesson, is that acceptance does not mean giving up. Yes. And for the longest time, I think part of what held me back in a way was I didn't want to accept the fact that I was paralyzed, because my mind or my body might think, okay, well, if you accept it, you're no longer going to work to overcome that. And while I might not overcome or have overcome the physical definition of paralysis, I've certainly overcome the mental definition. I think that was more damaging to me. Having your body taken away from you is one thing, but losing your mind or not having control over your attitude and how you choose to take on each day, I'd much rather, you know, have a paralyzed body than a paralyzed attitude. And so I think once I realized that I still had control of that attitude, I still had the ability to, you know, to choose the mood I wanted to be in or to choose how hard I was going to work, you know, I just became so much more grateful for having that opportunity.
Well, and look at the book that you wrote. I mean, the book that you wrote was so healing to me, even just reading it and being like, okay, that experience got a little bit normalized, right? Of that guilt and that feeling of, oh my goodness. And then just being able to see what you're still able to accomplish. And I love the fact that you say, hey, I'd rather lose my physical body than my mental. Because that mental game makes so much possible for all of us. And it's so important to have it in a healthy space. And not only did you write a book, but you're hired to give speeches and you make an income giving speeches. And you started a charity called Getting Back Up. So talk briefly about those before we close up today.
Yep, sure. And again, these are all things that, you know, when I was laying in a bed, never in a million years would I think that I would have found fulfillment in a life where my physicality was taken away, but I have. First thing I'll talk about is the charity, Getting Back Up. It's Getting Back Up. And if people want to learn more about it, just gettingbackup.org. If anyone knows people out there that may have a spinal cord injury and are looking for help and for resources, what we seek to do is to help individuals where insurance won't, whether it's with exercise-based therapy or adaptable products. And this was all a, you know, the brainchild for this idea was I was sitting in a nursing home after I'd gotten out of the hospital and my physical therapy ended and was taken away from me because insurance kind of decided, all right, you know, if you're not walking out of here, there's only so much we can do for you. And that was the one thing that was getting me up and going every day, keeping me charged, was that therapy. And I just thought, you know, this is awful. Like, you know, now you're taking away that one opportunity I have to continue to feel good and to want to, you know, work my body. And fortunately, I had a, you know, a strong support network of family and friends, but there's a lot of individuals out there that don't. And that was kind of the impetus for Getting Back Up, was those people who don't have the friends or the resources or the ability to maybe have a fundraiser to raise money for therapy. You know, what are they going to do when they're told that your therapy has been taken away, or we can't, you know, we don't have money to get you adaptable computer software or other things to make your life a little bit more, you know, easy. So that was where Getting Back Up came. And that was founded around 2011, 2012. You know, we've helped almost close to 300 individuals as of today. So it's extremely rewarding. And then the other side is I started doing some speaking engagements. Wasn't really looking to, but kept getting asked by people that would meet me. Hey, can you come share your story with my, either, you know, their teacher, maybe my classroom or my business, my employees. People want to hear that. And one thing led to another, and I started to really enjoy getting out there telling my story. And for the longest time, everyone kept saying, you got to write a book. And I didn't want to write a book because I kept thinking, you know, my story's, what's there to tell? You know, I had the unfortunate, luck of diving into a shallow body of water and breaking my neck. You know, there's other people out there with much more exciting, more important stories to tell. But the more and more I kept having people come up to me telling me, hey, look, just listening to what you had to say, how you recovered, how you've chosen to live your life. It's really done a lot for me. I wish I could find a way to, you know, to share your story the proper way with others. And that's kind of was the impetus that led me to write the book. And, it was a successful book. It reached number one on a couple platforms, and, it's out there. And I hope that those that do choose to pick it up and read it can really find something in it that they can apply to their life to help them through with, we don't have to break our neck to face adversity, as you know. Adversity comes in a lot of different ways and hats it wears. So hopefully they can find a way to deal with whatever their, you know, whatever challenges are in their life that they need to overcome. And, it's been very rewarding, much more fulfilling path I'm on than I ever thought it would have been. So it really has been a godsend, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I found your book. I fell in love with you. I fell in love with the story. I'm so grateful that I got to share everything with my audience today, because in real life, you're just as amazing as you are on paper. And I'm so grateful you made that choice to say yes to life. There's more here to give. And my goodness, I can't wait to see how this keeps snowballing into bigger things. So thanks so much today, Scott.
Thank you, Jen. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and hopefully reach some of your viewers.